We went to go watch a Disney movie in the theaters, and all of a sudden these little coconut warrior guys are coming on a giant raft. And I lean over to my wife and I'm like, oh, we're going to make coconut warriors. I'm
funny?
You know, it's like, you know, that's where my mind instantly goes seeing those, like, oh my God, we've got to make some coconut warriors. Those are just too cool.
It is often refreshing to talk to somebody who just loves what they do. I sit down with Tom Anders of Impact Managers. I was amazed at the story of how he came to own the company, some of his successes as well as close calls, some new insights in the process of making miniatures. I think all of us can learn about the reality of running a gaming company. More than anything, Tom is funny, kind, and passionate. Make sure you stick around to the end, where we talk about what the future is of miniature manufacturing in light of 3D printing. A quick floorhead shout out to some of our newest patrons: Johan Hofflin, Michael Hengel, Ben Lawson, John Sheffield, and Connell Damiano. All right, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with Tom.
Third Floor Wars delivers interviews, insights, and discussions about everything hitting the tabletop. Rulebooks, plastic models, dice, and cards in hand. Let the gaming begin. Tabletop games let you escape and unleash grand battles and regale epic tales of adventure with your friends. If you love gaming and learning from players, designers, experts, and creators, you are in the right place. Pull up a chair. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Podcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we are talking to Tom Anders of Impact Miniatures. They are most known for their great minis for fantasy football and other sports-inspired mini games. Tom, welcome to the Third Floor.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Tom, you've been in the business for a while as a player and as a creator and stuff, but I want you to go back in time with me. So there was a day, and I have a feeling it wasn't yesterday, where you knew nothing about rolling dice and pushing miniatures and playing games. And then suddenly it was introduced to you. So I'd love to hear how old you were and how just miniature gaming was first introduced.
Miniature gaming. Okay, let's roll back. So first got into these style of games, junior high, first edition D&D.
Nice.
With the old, I had to use the crayon to color in dice.
To color in the dice.
That's right. Old school. That dates me right there for anyone who doesn't know my age.
I'm right there with you. And then if you're like me, like the white would come out of the number, so then you had to dig into your white Crayolas fill it in.
I still have those dice. My God, those dice do not age well. They're like so beat up. So that was really how I got into the whole gaming world, was an early D&D.
Yep.
That segued into Magic. And I became an actual competitive Magic player. I was ranked 13th in my state at the highest point that I reached.
Wow.
And that then segued into me figuring out how to pay for my Magic habit by buying the cards wholesale and selling them to a game store that didn't have the capital to do it themselves.
Right.
And then splitting the profit with them and then using that profit to buy more cards, which got me into the whole, oh, wow, you can play this hobby. And if you're not upset about being a business person, you can also pay for your hobby by getting other gamers to pay for your hobby.
Yep.
And that kind of started the whole seeds of, I'm a gamer, but I'm also someone who sells to gamers. The next game then that I started playing quite a bit of was Blood Bowl, and got very involved with that, into the league play. I played that for several years. got very involved in the online community. And again, when Games Workshop stopped supporting third edition, I got very involved in picking up miniatures from the secondary market and then turning them around and selling them. So that really was my introduction, and that was all through eBay. So that's kind of the early days of me miniature selling was I would spend a lot of time calling GW for their back catalog and buying old miniatures from their back catalog that were easily used as Blood Bowl figures, and then also hunting down the actual third edition and then selling them on eBay.
What's amazing to me about that, Tom, and I've talked about it on the show before, and believe it or not, I've never played Blood Bowl. I've watched it played. It's a little too spiky, dicey for me, but totally get the appeal. Totally get the appeal. Yeah. And I ended up finding home in Guild Ball, which, you know, is as a child. Let's be honest. It's a child of Blood Bowl, right?
Yes.
Though very different. But
yes,
what's interesting to me, and I've talked about it on the show before, is when Games Workshop laid down the game. I mean, I don't think there's another game that was held up by a community as much as Blood Bowl was. I mean, long after GW had forgotten about it, like, Blood Bowl tournaments were having like tons of people show up, like tons of people show up. It was unbelievable for a quote unquote unsupported game. And I'd be curious, Tom, why do you think that is? What was it about it that just kept it alive?
So in my opinion, one of the things that really helps is that despite the fact that it's a very dicey game, it really is a dice game where you can somewhat control the randomness by the by your strategy. The fact that you the NAF, which is the official organization that tracks tournament standings of players and has been around now for many, many years, there's a reason the same players are at the top of those charts.
If it was
just a random dice fest, that would not be the case.
No question. Same argument about poker, right? People that say poker is just a game of chance. Well, unfortunately, the numbers don't back you up. So,
you know, it's a lot about, and the other thing is the variety of the teams means that most players will not just bring the same team to every tournament.
Nice.
So, most players want to be diverse and have different experiences. There are actually awards on the NAF for managing to rank above a certain rating in every single team that's in the game.
Oh, which that's cool.
The last I knew, I think it's 25 teams.
Wow.
25 different teams. And so that variety, the fact that I can come in. Now, one of the things, I was a pretty good player in my leagues, so I became a big fan of playing Halflings because Halflings was one of the worst teams in the game. But I enjoyed the challenge of trying to win with that team. So you get some of that. So where does it come from? I think that there's the number of teams and the depth of the strategy. The fact that it's a very intense game that, despite being a war game, if you're playing between two players that know what they're doing and one doesn't take forever to think, it should be playable in 2 hours every time you sit down.
And that's a huge selling
point. Right. Nowadays, and I know from having Impact Miniatures, there's a big push to get those. If you come out with a new game, playing time's over an hour, and all of a sudden you've like crossed some magic threshold. But the serious strategy miniature games with Blood Bowl coming in at 2 hours is very good. And the other thing, the thing that Games Workshop I still believe does right is the lore. The lore behind Blood Bowl is amazing. I mean, I love it. There was entire sites dedicated to building on the lore or documenting all the pieces of the lore.
That is one thing that they've always gotten right, though. Let's be honest. I mean, people can sit and criticize at Games Workshop all day long, but they nail the lore every time.
And in fact, my long before I ever started Impact Miniatures, my online name was Galak Starscraper, who in Blood Bowl lore is the Storm Giant referee who was the only, was the largest referee that ever came in the game, mainly because he showed up and said, I want to be a referee. And they said, no. And he stomped six people into the ground. They're like, hey, fine. And I just, I tend to be very forceful in a conversation when I'm having a debate. And that just seemed to be a matchup. And I've also been always extremely interested in the rules of games and how to make them better. Even when I was a young kid, I would write like custom rules for the board games that my parents would give me. So I was very involved in the communities discussing the rules. How do we make this better? Long before Fnatic came out and tried to bring Blood Bowl back for the next edition. So
let's go back even farther, Tom. I mean, obviously your addiction before that was Magic the Gathering, and listeners have heard this before, but I was part of the beta for Magic the Gathering. Wow. That's how old I am. It would have been 94.
Wow.
93, 94. I finished the beta, and as a thank you, Wizards sent out a full set of the first edition, right?
Of Alpha. Holy crap.
Not Alpha. I didn't get the Alphas. Oh. I owned some Alphas, but I only had, but I had a full beta set. So I had a full beta set, had all the moxes and everything, right? And this is like,
and you've made the mistake of selling that before. Oh,
it wasn't a mistake. Well, I mean, it's a mistake if you think of it now, but so I sold. Now, remember, there's no eBay, right? All it was back there was text-based bulletin boards. I sold my full beta set. It had to been 94, 95 ish is what I'm guessing, for like $4,500. For the whole set of cards, which now you're like, well, Craig, you're an idiot. That's like, you know, $12,000 worth. But back then, to sell a set of cards for, you know, $5,000 was just like unbelievable. And I mean, I remember the first time I played the game and I was just like, oh, this is a great game. But there was no way I would have ever predicted that 25 years later, it would be bigger now than it's ever been before, that it was only grown. So what was it for you, Tom? What made you say, holy crap, I need to come up with a way to feed my addiction because I love this game so much? What did you love about it?
It was getting, well, I love strategy games. And I think that's part of why the randomness and blah, blah. I mean, Magic is, again, controlled randomness.
Yep.
And I've never forgotten the first tournament I ever won. I sat down and I knew one of the best players was this player that absolutely loved red. And I sat down, I made it to the final match against him, just as I kind of thought would happen. And he just started stomping me. And I was like, you know what? I concede. And the players were all like, you're not even going to finish. I'm like, no, I quit. And they're like, what? Like, first match to him, grabbed my sideboard, which was entirely designed only for him.
Right.
Threw in 15 cards specifically designed to screw his deck and wipe the floor with him to win my first tournament.
Isn't that something?
That type of gameplay, and I mean, that's just not the game itself, but that's a whole nother layer of reading the room, knowing what you think is going to be there to come in advance. Oh, I absolutely love that. And my specialty was sealed deck. Those are the tournaments I love to go to. Open the pack and in minutes try and figure out what is it that will get me to the end of this and win the prize.
It's so cool.
So it's, I just love those layers of strategic thinking and strategy. And in a similar story, you selling your set, Impact was started from the money I got from selling my Magic card collection.
That's amazing.
So I got $10,000
that's
from
awesome.
Selling my Magic card collection. And that was the seed capital that was used to start Impact Miniatures in 2006.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
So do you now, have you fell back in? Do you still play a little Magic here and there?
Is there
any other card games that tempt you at all?
I'm very involved in a mobile game.
Okay. Which one?
Dungeon Boss. And I'm actually the leader of one of the top. I'm actually the leader of one of the guilds and one of the top guild families. Currently ranked the 14th most powerful player in that game.
Nice.
So that's when I take time off, that's what I do. But I don't play with I just don't have the raw time. So where I segued into how big the company's gone, my family, I am not joking. I normally work 90-hour weeks. Impact is very demanding. It is a company that needs to have a full-time person helping me, and doesn't. My family is awesome. What we ended up doing about a year ago, and this kind of gets into, I mean, some of the setup, but Impact really now has three major products. The miniatures business, my oldest son takes care of. The dice business, my wife helps me take care of, and my youngest son helps with the 3D printing. And then I kind of keep everything running. So
it's truly a family business, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. So guys, the Insider Insight series allows me to talk to developers, designers, artists, writers, and industry insiders about their creative process and how they approach their work. Today, we will learn how Impact Miniatures came to be, Tom's process for designing and creating great miniatures and games, and what it takes to run a company in the gaming industry. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to learn more about the formation of Impact Miniatures and what it is. We'll be right back.
DZ Leergard here, creator of the M3E Crew Builder app, and I'm a patron of Third Floor Wars because supporting great content creators like them is one of the best ways to help grow this game. So to join me and the other floorheads, go to patreon.com and search for Third Floor Wars, and we will see you there.
Right now is the part of many podcasts where someone comes on, interrupts the show, and explains that you should consider paying for the content you're already getting for free. They'll go on and explain that by giving a dollar or more a month, you not only support the show, but you allow the show to grow and improve. Here on the Third Floor, we commit to not interrupting your episode of Tabletop Talk with such a plea. We pledge not to run a spot asking you to go to patreon.com and give a dollar or more a month. Even if there's a link in this show's description, and there is, we won't ask you to click it and become a patron. We won't spend time yammering about the benefits like early access to episodes, getting those episodes without ad breaks, or even getting a chance to play in one of Craig's RPG sessions. Anyway, enjoy this episode. We needed to clarify that we wouldn't do this type of solicitation. I'd like to take a moment to give a shout out to some of the original patrons that started us on this journey. Special thanks to Jesse Ellis, Sam Newman, Nick Westbrook, Jim Ortiz, Kevin Smith, Keith Suderman, Matthew Riddle, Dane Leergard, Jeremy Peace, Wookie Gunner, Chris Blue, Vaslav, Kim Otto Nielsen, Rolf Randall, John Haas, Cody Hyatt, Michael Roper, Ambrose Ingram, Pudgy Hobbit, Kaiser and Crimson, Brandon Sommer, Jason Reddy, Jason Burry, Kylie Woodland, Brian Schooner, Alan Voltz, and Owen. Because of you and the 100 other plus patrons, I'm able to put out content on a regular basis, and I appreciate it. So now that we kind of get an idea of who Tom is and how Tom fell into everybody's favorite addiction, tabletop gaming, and we peeked in a little bit to see how Impact Miniatures, you know, the seed money came from selling Magic cards. But what I want to do, Tom, is first of all, get an idea of when did you just stop for a second and say, I'm going to sell all my Magic cards and start a mini company. What pushed you over the edge? Was it a thought that you had been considering for a while, or?
So actually, I didn't start Impact.
Oh, okay.
Impact was started by a group of six other guys, led by Ewan McCurcher. I think I got Ewan's last. I don't think I ever heard Ewan pronounce his last name. Ewan was a sculptor, and he sculpted this really cool fantasy football Yeti snow troll. And then people are like, I want to buy it. I want to buy it. And so he started selling it to him. And I guess my understanding is that over drinks, him and five other guys decided we could start a miniature company and Ewan will sculpt the minis and we'll figure out some way to sell them. And then several of those six guys said, hey, you should bring Tom in. Now, this is like, we're at only the second week of talking at this point. And they're right. like, look, Tom is so involved in this, in the game side and the online right. community. We think he could really help the company. So they sent me an invite, like, would you like to join us for this effort to create a new company? And I said, yes. And we could do a whole nother podcast on what the next year was like. But let us say that 2 years later, the seven people were down to three.
Wow.
Including the guy who was the sculptor was gone.
Jeez, so, okay.
Like I said, this could be a whole nother podcast to describe that whole story. And then I actually looked this up so I would get the dates right. And then, yeah, by 2000, so we started in April of 2006, we opened. By 2008, we were down to just three members.
Wow.
In 2010, my current business partner, Chris Ackerson, he bought out one of the partners. And then in 2011, Chris and I bought out the third partner.
Now, I'd be curious, Tom, when they ring you up, what were you doing? How were you making a living when you got called and said, hey, do you want to help out?
I was a financial business auditor.
Okay.
So my job was I would go into companies and I would write programs to go through their financial data and make sure that they were on the up and up.
Right.
Which creates some fun stories because, yes, I did find fraud in my time doing that. So
I'm sure. I work for one of the big four firms, and we have an entire audit division. Price, so very familiar
Price,
with it.
Yeah. PricewaterhouseCoopers for 20 years.
Oh, okay. Nice.
So that's what I was doing when they got hold of me. And I ran. I quickly became the person that was running Impact very shortly after all of this got set up. It turns out the guy with the CPA who's actually had already done the actively buying and selling miniatures for years on the side through eBay was the one, you know, that ended up quickly taking over.
Well, yeah, you had the background. You had the background from both sides, right? You had familiarity with it from a hobby perspective, and obviously you came from a financial background, which is huge. Right.
And I definitely can tell you from those, I definitely understand why they say 80% of small businesses fail in the first 2 years. We had a great advantage. Everyone in that company, nobody needed that money at that time. So it was a weekend business. We made nothing. Like, I don't think Impact turned a profit until it was 6 years old. But it was fun because any money we got, we're like, oh, let's make another miniature. Here, Mr. Sculptor, have all our money. And so, you know, it was a great time. And then things changed in 2010. So the company's now been open for 4 years. My company outsourced the entire programming, division to India.
Wow. Okay.
And laid off my entire group. So, you know, 20 years with the company and poof, it's like gone. Yeah,
that's how it happens, unfortunately.
Yeah. And, I laugh because that failed miserably, but you know, that didn't get me my job.
That's funny.
But I sat down with my wife and I'm like, well, I can try and find another job, or we can take this miniature company that isn't turning a profit and really go all in,
right,
and try and make that work. And then I'll be able to work from home. And so we agreed to a test. And that was, I had two car payments at that time. And we went out to the miniature world or the forums and all the online and said, hey, we need, and I don't even remember the amount, but the payoff amount for the two vehicles, we need that much in sales this month, extra. We get this, I will go do Impact full time. We don't get this, Impact might become something that very rarely releases a new Mini. It becomes truly a hobby business.
Yeah,
because I was going to have to start over.
A little Kickstarter action there. Yeah, huh?
And we got the money to pay off both of my vehicles, which reduced how much money I needed every month just to get along. Yep. And so I got 20 years with one of those big four companies. They actually gave me a fairly decent severance package.
Nice.
And so that gave me money for 1 year.
Yep.
Which was what I spent. Remember, I told you it was 5 years before we turned profitable. Well, that's what I did with my severance package. Was spent 1 year living off of that. Like, this company has to become profitable right now.
So Tom, you know, at some point you bridge the mark and you go from the red to the black on there. Mm. Looking back on it now, do you have a sense of what pushed it over the edge? What did you do? What did the team do? What did Impact Miniatures do to finally turn that corner? Do you remember? Or was it just so gradual and just kind of happened?
One of the biggest things for us that turned that corner was we got into a very early relationship with one of the very first ever centrifuge resin casters.
Interesting.
And what that meant was we could produce an entire fantasy football team with 16 to 18 models and sell it for $35.
Wow.
And at $35, we could even wholesale it to mom and pop shops. So the cost on the product was low enough. And that was new. We were the very first company to really do that high volume mass production. Now, they weren't as I've always been free to admit, they were not as prettily sculpted as some of the other companies. But it at that time, it was a comparison of, hey, I can get an entire team that's pretty well sculpted for $35, or I can buy a metal team for $120. And that really was one of the big things that changed things. And then the other major change that came about so that was the first thing that kept things profitable enough to get going. And then we got into making chibi models, which is a Japanese art style.
Yeah, with the big heads and the big eyes.
And We were the first company to mass produce singles in a large volume scale, like hundreds of different options, rather than, there was other companies that were doing it. Soda Pop, Cool Mini or not, but you had to buy sets, or the singles were really expensive. They were like $15-$20, and we were selling them for $4 to $5 for, wow, you know, different singles. So those two things led us to have enough money day to day that was able to keep everything going. And then the other really big one, and I did not look this up because I didn't think you might ask this question, but we got into Ryan Mitchell suggested to us, hey, you should check out this website, Kickstarter. And I went into Kickstarter, and because of all of my financial background and all of that, Kickstarter made a lot of sense to me.
Sure.
I spend a lot of time online, so I was already very ingrained in all of the online communities where you get the free advertising. And so we just grabbed Kickstarter and started running with it. And there are flat out years, I will tell you, that it was Kickstarter revenue that kept everything going.
Wow.
Impact is actually, there's a website you can go to that actually tracks all of the people in the tabletop area of Kickstarter by total money raised and all of that. But if you look at number of successful projects, Impact is now in the top 10.
That's cool.
And we are actually right now running our 41st successful Kickstarter.
That's something. Now, I've had a couple other companies come on, and we've heard success stories and horror stories when it comes to Kickstarter. But I would imagine with, again, your financial background and your ability to manage the money when it's brought to you up front has to have given you an advantage to allow you to take the best of Kickstarter and avoid some of the pitfalls. Does that sound accurate?
That is accurate for 95% of my projects.
That's great.
If you look at my history, the Kickstarter I had that made the most money broke over $100,000. Yeah, that one ended up costing me $130,000. So yeah. So it just a lot of things you don't realize. The company that was going to do the casting overpromised on what right. they'd be able to do, and so sent us a lot of stuff that was garbage, and we had to remake molds and entirely redo production runs. This is something I warn people about when I'm advising people about doing Kickstarter. It took so long to work with the miniature production company that UPS did a rate hike, and it was one of the biggest they'd ever done in their history.
That's brutal.
And the shipping cost almost doubled for the project overnight. And all of a sudden you were like, hey, we made $100,000. Oh, I have to take out. And I actually took out a loan against my house and that is one of the things I always tell people. Like, they're always like, oh, Kickstarter's, it's a gamble. You could get screwed. And I says, look, I have gone into personal financial debt to make sure every project I have ever done delivers.
I have become a much smarter. I have a Kickstarter addiction. I'm probably just over a dozen now, been completely screwed back.
Oh, wow. That's
the good news is that on a percentage basis, I'm doing all right. you learn one thing that's good. And it's why you can't get away with this for very long. All of us become a lot smarter as consumers, and, being able to look at Impact Miniatures and say, you know what, they've created 40, they've delivered on 40. Here's the feedback. I can go back and look at it. I can look at the comments section of their past ones. That adds up and it snowballs. So good for you. But I don't envy you. That must have been a scary period of time, man, saying, okay, I'm going to leverage the house now. Let's see how this goes. But
we really believed that the Chibi were going to sell. And in fact, the very first Gen Con that we took the Chibi to, we literally had people walk away from our booth because their lines were so long that very first year. Now, unfortunately, it's not like that now. We've also gotten much better at filling the orders. So I'd like to think it's a little column A, a little, demand went a little down, but we also got a lot better at getting people taken care of. So
you've given me a great transition. I'd be really curious what this last year's been like, Tom, with COVID and people not going to game stores and not sitting across the table with each other. How did that impact the business?
So we got hit by a double whammy. One, we lost all of our convention sales. Basically, we thought we had conventions, and then within a period of 3 weeks, all of my conventions canceled. It's not as bad. Well, I was talking to one of my friends in the miniature business, And, you know, it's always one of those, you think it's bad and then you get to talk to somebody else. And you're like, oh, maybe, you know, it's not so bad. He lost 80% of his sales in three weeks because that's how much he makes on his conventions for his company. For us, one of the examples we actually, and this is the accountant in me, Impact uses a 13-month calendar.
Right.
The 13th month is Gen Con.
Yep.
That tells you just right there how big that 1 4-day event is for my company.
Right.
And then Adepticon is like a mini Gen Con. We usually make about 50% of the sales at Adepticon that we will at Gen Con, which always amazes me because it's like a tenth of the number of people. But
it's a little bit more focused than Gen Con, right?
It's a miniature gaming convention. Hey, right. Miniature company. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. It's a better match. Absolutely.
No, it's all right. The other brutal part about that, Tom, is that it's not like you just, you know, 3 weeks before Gen Con, you know, put together your inventory and head out. I mean, you've got to plan way ahead and spend money on getting the inventory and making the arrangements. So it's not just, it can't be just lost sales time. It's sunk money, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, right now, I'm actually looked at my wife within the last week and said, oh, this is just killing me because Gen Con is still not. They literally post every week like, hey, we're still trying to decide. And I'm like, well, I can't pull the trigger and start ramping up inventory because just a sunk cost. I says, but I also don't want to have, I'm not looking forward to dealing with the stress if they say, yeah, we're doing it. And I'm like, I mean, that's so to put it in perspective. The other problem that we had is that several years ago, Impact started producing dice for several different games. And that has become a major branch of the company. A manufacturer that was making our dice just got hold of me one day, called me and said, hey, we've decided that we're changing what our company does. We're no longer going to make dice. I tried to get hold of another company. I tried to get hold of several companies. No one wanted to make the type of dice that I make. I finally found a company that was willing to do it. And they're like, well, we can't. I says, okay, old company, send the molds to the new company. Right. New company gets the molds and says, we can't use any of these. They don't match any of our equipment. They're totally unusable. So I lost... That was approximately $40,000 in dice molds that I lost. The dice was a major component of our business. At the start of COVID, it had been 2 years since I'd been able to restock. Now, thankfully, the last Kickstarter that I had done, we had extra money. So I says, hey, you know what? I'm going to really beef up inventory and get my cost per unit down. If it wasn't for that, I honestly, that event probably is the only thing that kept Impact open.
Incredible.
During last year is that I still had just enough dice but we actually, we sell on Amazon quite a bit. And I had actually had to take 70% of our inventory off of Amazon because it was out of stock. Wow. So I finally find a new manufacturer. I'm all excited, and COVID hits. Manufacturer completely shuts down. So I can't restock my dice. I lose all of my conventions. By the end of October, we were 40% down on sales versus 2019. And this is our sole source of income. So for say whatever you want about the government, and this is a non-political statement, I listened to a YouTuber called Meet Kevin, and he was awesome every day for updating on here's some place you might be able to go and get some money. And I was able to get five different government assistance programs from the PPP to the EIDL. to a local Spark program, all from listening to him when he said, this just opened, get in line, because a lot of those ran out. Like if you didn't get in line, like in the first week, all of a sudden the money was all gone. So listening to him gave us enough money to fill the holes so that we could pay the bills. You know, mortgage forgiveness. Yay. I can go, you know, I don't have to pay my mortgage for 6 months. Okay. Thank you. That really helps. So it was a collection of all that. And then November came, and November was my dice arrived from the company. And so for the first time in now 2.5 years, I'm able to restock a major part of my business. And we actually sold enough dice in November and December that we actually finished 2020 23% higher than 2019.
How crazy is that, Tom? That's amazing. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, my friend. I have stuff to sell.
I cannot imagine how deep that sigh of relief was. Wow. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, when that semi pulls up, that was a happy day. So
I bet it was.
But the miniature side of the business, the sales were down. But by this point, by the start of 2020, miniatures were now down to about 25% of my total sales.
No kidding.
So while those sales were down, that wasn't hitting me as hard as around 2020, my company was, and it's probably still about that spot right now, is 25% of sales for miniatures, 25% from 3D printing, on demand for people doing custom things. They send them to us to print for them, and then 50% dice.
Isn't that something?
That's where we moved to.
That's amazing. So what are the hopes and dreams of the future, Tom? So what are you hoping? Is there something you're thinking that, you'd want to expand into? Is it just a matter of doing more of what's working now?
Mostly, yes. So, the dice business, since I've now only basically been able to jump back into the dice business for 5 months.
Yeah.
So that's all of a sudden I had a 2.5 year break and now I can jump back in. And so now you're like researching new colors and new options, the games that we make the dice for. I'm talking to them like, what can we do to help your games? I keep expanding my 3D printing business. And actually I have a number of licenses that I have print licenses for that. I really just need to get, prints set up into the store. So it's probably going forward, you're looking at, on the miniature side, you're going to see an expansion for us on the miniature side from us using those print licenses to get prints of all those 3D prints into the store. I recently expanded to have a fourth printer so that we could handle high volume 3D printing projects. And I've actually helped a total of 10 Kickstarters produce their models to send to their customers. And then we actually are working on a new fourth. Well, I joke. I says, well, hopefully it'll be the fourth branch. I hope it's that big. There has not been a good miniature base supplier ever in the United States.
I agree.
They all come from overseas, and everyone always got them from overseas because they were extremely reliable. Well, I'm not, at no point in time I'm going to name names, but that reliability factor dropped through the roof about 6 months ago. The company shut down its operations in one country. They moved to another. They let go about 90% of their staff. And now the major base manufacturer in the world, it's really hard to get hold of them. And so I reached out to my dice manufacturer and I says, look, I've never even looked into this because they were so cheap through this other place, but I actually had people reaching out to me. Where are you still getting your bases from? Like, we can't get bases for our miniatures. And so I dropped about $25,000 on having steel molds made to start my own base business in the U.S. Awesome. Like high volume. So we'll see if that works. This is and it's such a minor thing. Like, it's not super cool, like a detailed miniature or really, you know, cool looking dice, but it's a staple.
And yeah, we need them. So that's good.
and mass production plastic bases are still cheaper than even if you have a 3D printer. Even if you're using PLA, you're still not printing them for, you know, that much, or just the hassle. So that's my next big project that I sunk a ton of money into, is to try and become a US-based bases manufacturer. And
that is cool.
We'll see if that works.
So guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to really take advantage of the fact that I've yet to have somebody on the show that really has created, you know, brought miniatures to life from beginning to end. So we're going to talk to Tom about the adventure of making a mini. We'll be right back. Howdy friends, Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order. In the notes of your order, you can even request the third floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats, save yourself some money, and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code. So like I mentioned before the break, I've got my share of minis. I think I've got half of my audience's shares of minis. I've got minis for about 7 different games. Some are painted, some have never been opened. So I'm very familiar with purchasing minis. What I'm not familiar with, Tom, is how they make it. So I guess my first question, Tom, is where does the initial ideas come from? So I think of a good example, a miniature where you or maybe your partner said, you know, hey, here's an idea for a miniature. Where do those ideas come from?
So like our Chibi line came from my silent partner, Chris Ackerson, who really believed that they were a new and upcoming area to get into. And so he actually found an artist for us, and then it was, let's make a whole bunch of fantasy and adventures, and that kind of took off. Really what it comes down to is when we make a miniature, it's a mix of either one or two things, either a game that we've played or read about has mentioned, you know, no one makes a miniature for X. So I spend at least, and this always surprises me when I talk to people who run miniature companies, and I've seen this numerous times from, oh, I'm so busy, I never have time to read the internet. And I'm like, how? Because that's where our ideas usually come from. Yeah, how do you stay ahead? You know, where, how do you know what people are like, gosh, I wish somebody would make a miniature for X. Okay. So a lot of our ideas come from that. Then the other side of it is, I see something like, and I go, wow, I want to make that. My wife laughs. She goes, you know, this is the type of husband I am. We went to go watch a Disney movie in the theaters, and all of a sudden these little coconut warrior guys are coming on a giant raft. And I lean over to my wife and I'm like, oh, we're going to make coconut warriors. I'm
funny?
You know, it's like, you know, that's where my mind instantly goes seeing those, like, oh my God, we've got to make some coconut warriors. Those are just too cool.
So where do you go? So you get inspired by the coconut warriors, Tom. Do you then have artists that you work with to say, hey, let's get some 2D sketches of this?
we have some really great artists. We used to use artists to sketch out everything ahead of time. Fortunately now, most of the new sculpts that we make lately are all chibi based. Uh-huh. The reason that that's true is because there are a ton of excellent fantasy football companies in Europe right now. And they have crowded that market with some beautiful stuff.
Right.
And what sliver of the pie do you want to play with when you develop something new?
Yeah. You have to be nimble, right, Tom?
Right. Right. So I haven't invested. I do have some new fantasy football stuff I'm working on. But it's slow in the pipe compared to some of the other projects. I mean, we've been running. I'm running my third chibi Kickstarter that I've put up in the last 4 months.
Wow.
And all of them have reached over 10K.
And that's something.
So, you know, that's people love those, you know, they love the chibi, and that's an easy hit with our audience. So
do you have a 2D artist sketch these out first, or do you go right to a 3D artist?
Lorraine Seltzer, absolutely amazing chibi artist. So we used to do that because we used to say, hey, we want a, and we would kind of describe. And nowadays, a lot of times what we'll do is get an inspiration from, I have a Funimation account, so I watch a lot of anime. And a lot of times what I'll do is grab screenshots, and I'll go to, I have two very talented chibi sculptors that I work with, and I'll be like, hey, I love this pose. And I'm not trying to copy someone's IP, but say, hey,
sure.
I think if we could make, like, you know, it's some type of pose, like, I see that, and I'm like, wow, wouldn't it be really cool if we had like a bear barbarian in that pose, like that fantasy guy? Let's give him a great big axe. And I mean, so a lot of times what we might be doing is sending an actual picture from something else as inspiration for a pose. I've studied a lot of medieval weaponry. So a lot of times I'll be like, and let's pull out this weapon that no one ever sees, and let's put hit that on him. And so they're really good taking just that kind of generic description and just going straight to sculpting.
Wow, that's great.
In fact, my one sculptor, Herberto, does a Twitch stream. He runs Marchan Miniatures. I highly recommend it. Twice a month, he sculpts a chimney model live, start to finish, in like 2 hours. Just amazing to watch him do it. And so I work with him, and I have a contract with him to get one chibi model a month from him. And so every month it's like, hey, what do we want to do? You know, like the model for last month was a honey badger druid. So it really just depends on what sounds. A lot of times with the chibi, it's what sounds fun.
Sure,
because that's what sells chibi. Is it fun?
Right, and obviously having an understanding of what's out there, right, and what's not out there, and being able to sort through that, find a weapon that nobody else is using in a style or a pose. I would also think, Tom, that you know, over time, working with the same artist over and over and over again, that you know, he begins to be able to speak Tom, right? So that you can explain what you're thinking, and he's now worked with you long enough that you've got that back and forth, that he's able to translate what's in your brain and you know, and sculpt it live on Twitch, which is amazing. So that's got to be huge.
That helps quite a bit. The other thing that helps is I've been constantly trying to teach myself Mesh Mixer and Photoshop for years. And so what can happen is a lot of times they'll do a sculpt and send me a picture or a digital file, and I'll be like, not quite what I want, and be able to pull it up and actually with Photoshop, like, this needs to, you know, this needs to be bigger and this move over here, and can give that type of feedback. And so everything nowadays, I stopped using hand sculptors. What was the last hand sculpt thing we did? I think we're probably at 6 years ago. I think the last time I used a hand sculpt.
Almost everybody does it digitally now.
The biggest, and I know a lot of people have, that have cried that that day and age is leaving. But the digital models, if you find a good digital sculptor, the fact that you can take and go, you know what? I think the head needs to be just a little bit bigger.
Yep. Four keystrokes later.
In the old days, you've just basically destroyed that person. Like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. You know, like, and now, you know, we had one product where the character was supposed to have like antenna coming off the sides of their mouth. Not antenna, more like mandibles, right?
Mandibles, right.
And I had a look for them. And I kept going back to Roberto, like, no, they're too wide. Okay, now they're too thick. Well, no, what the heck did you just do with that edit? No, that's not what I meant at all. You know, we must have changed those mandibles 7 times. And then I'm like, perfect, you got it. That was probably the worst editing thing I ever did to poor Roberto.
So the other thing about the 3D sculpting, too, is the technology's come a long way. I mean, you know, it used to be you could spot them, right? When we were used to hand sculpted miniatures, we could spot the digitally sculpted ones a mile away. You could just tell. And now you can't. And now, quite frankly, they're better. And the ability to.
Part of that's the printers.
Right.
So the digital sculptor used to be able to make something great, but the printer couldn't print those details.
Right.
So when they got turned into a mass produced model, you could instantly look at it and go, no, that doesn't have the detail. But now the printers have caught up for the most part to the digital sculptors.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And now you can produce a master from a 3D printer that you can actually mass produce and have the quality of the hand sculpt. So
that leads to my next question, Tom. So the next step is, all right, you finalize the sculpt, the digital sculpt, you then 3D print it, and then do you send that off and get a mold made? Is that what's next?
Depends on how many you think you're going to make.
Okay.
I always say if you think you're going to sell more than 100, then yeah, it probably makes sense to. So you've got to get over the hurdle of the mold costs.
Yeah.
So for me, with the places that I go to right now and have worked with, if I want to turn a master copy of a model into a mass production model, that's about a $600 investment. So I now have to decide, how many of these am I going to make? Because I can just start mass producing those on my 3D printer immediately, and I'm $600 ahead.
Right.
However, the unit costs much, much higher on my 3D printer.
Yep.
Especially since we use really, really high-end 3D printers that print with virtually no mold lines whatsoever. And when I say that, I mean, you might be able to see one in the print, but as soon as you prime it, you would never know that it was 3D printed.
Right.
And because of that material, like we were actually looking, like one of the models I just 3D printed for a Kickstarter was one that we've also mass produced, but I promised that everything would be one piece, and in the mold it's multiple. That's the other big change, is like, do you care whether it's one piece or multiple piece? But so I had a multi-piece model that in the Kickstarter I offered as a one piece printed model. The multi-piece model is cost me 50 cents. To 3D print the model is 75 cents.
It's a big difference.
So, you know, that's a 50% increase in the cost of production. And so that affects, you know, that's not so bad at small volume, but you start moving a 50% price up, and now if a model costs $2 to make, well, now it's $3 to make in the 3D print, maybe. Or so it's comfort. You know, you just have to overlook at the molding and where is the line. And it also has to do with the line of how much do I really think I can sell this for? Because while it's much easier for me just to 3D print things, if it means I have to sell it for $30 instead of $20, do I think anybody wants to buy it at 30? If not, then yeah, I probably need to, and if I really believe in the model, I need to invest in the molding so that I can sell it at $20.
Well, and that, and again, this is where your time spent being in the consumer side of the market, scouring the internet, seeing things, watching how what other people are making, watching what other people are selling it for. I mean, that's how you keep track of that, right? That's how you make sure that, you know, you're not behind, and you get a sense of what the market will bear, which is a very big deal. Well, that helps a ton, man. So let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit about the industry. I want to get an idea of what Tom thinks about the miniature gaming industry in general. We'll be right back. Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com. That's with one M. Or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code Third Floor Friend, all one word, THIRDFLOORFRIEND, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats. So, I mean, Tom's been in this industry as a consumer and as a, you know, as a business owner and a creator for a good bit of time. So I'd be really interested, Tom, you know, looking at the arc of miniatures, right? So we go all the way back to Citadel and, you know, all of the iterations. And now we are, you know, we've got several companies that are successful miniature companies that are putting out stuff. I'd be curious, what do you think about kind of the current trends in the business? Do you think that miniature gaming's in a good place, getting bigger, getting smaller? What are your thoughts?
I truly believe this is a kind of a golden age as a gamer for having the miniatures. The bottom line is, since I'm so involved in Kickstarter, since it's such a major part of my business, the number of really talented sculptors and companies who are producing digital model Kickstarters for just incredible stuff. And a lot of these, when they go, it's not, hey, I want to. So in the old, when I first started doing Kickstarter, it was like, hey, we'd like to make 3 models. Please help us kickstart that, right? Because hand sculpting and all the molding. And now it's, hey, we're going to produce 80 new fantasy models that are just elves doing elf stuff. We have, here's an elf riding a bear. Here's an elf being carried by a hawk.
Here's a bear riding an elf.
You know, it's, and all of a sudden you've got 80 models, and okay, so maybe you don't have a 3D printer, but most of those projects lately have been partnering ahead of time with someone that does 3D printing and saying, hey, we've already tested our stuff with XYZ company, and here's the prices. And that's actually my my last 3 Kickstarters have been. So three Kickstarters ago, I worked with a sculptor in Canada, digital sculptor in Canada, and we ran a project together where we offered his digital files, and then I took all of his digital files, I set them up ahead of time, and then offered a physical print option with the Kickstarter. Then my last Kickstarter was my own models that I had physically produced 6 years ago that I finally have decided to pull the trigger and let people have the original digital files, even though I sell the physical copies.
Right.
And so I ran a Kickstarter to make those digital files available and to also sell the physical one piece, because most of those models were multi-piece models because of what you have to do to mold versus what you sure. do for 3D printing. And then the one I'm running right now is for a whole bunch of really cute chibi models based on a game that a lot of people would recognize if they went to the Kickstarter, that is with another company, and they're making the digital files. And then he sent them all to me in advance, and I set up, well, here's what it would cost to print them all. And so we have print option for people without it. And then we, so, you know, my last three Kickstarters have all been that world. Like, hey, we want to produce, and all of them have produced 25, 50, 80 new models. But if you got a 3D printer, here you go. Here's a whole bunch of new models. And the digital side of it, you're normally picking these up for, it depends on the project, but $1 to $3 a piece for brand new models. And yeah, you got to go print them yourself, but, you know, you get to pick and choose. And, if you're any good with mesh mixer or ZBrush, a lot of times you can take those 3D files and do small modifications. You don't like the fact that the guy's holding a sword? Slice, slice, slice. I can change that into a mace in like a minute with right. mesh mixer. So many new options, so easy to get. You don't have to have a 3D printer. You just have to find someone who's really good
right.
and has good prices, like my company.
So question for you, Tom, I'd be curious about this. I think if I had a dollar for every blog post that said that miniatures are going to be dead in the next year because of 3D printing, I wouldn't have to put out this dumb podcast. Is 3D printing going to be the end of GW and miniature gaming, and you know everybody's just going to go digital and print their own stuff? It's been foretold for a long time and hasn't happened yet. And do you think it will, or do you think there's always going to be a space for people that make miniatures and sell them?
No. So to answer your question, no, miniatures aren't going to die. The basic reason is, until you get to the sci-fi level where I press the button and all of a sudden magically whoop, and then 20 seconds later, I pull this ready to play model out of the little easy bake oven.
Right.
It's still, I mean, yeah. You know, you can get some inexpensive resin printers now for $400, but you know, at the end of the day, that is alone a sunk cost. Of, I just want to play D&D, and I want to have one guy to represent myself while I play D&D. I'm not going out and buying a $400 printer.
Well, not only that, Tom, but like, you know, if I have the choice of buying a $400 printer or spending $400 on miniatures, I'd rather spend $400 on the miniatures, and they're ready. They're done.
The other side of that is, it goes back to my easy bake oven. I mean, this, I spent years learning how to fine tune and make my printers work reliably. I spent the first year with a 35% failure rate, and that I was happy about. Like, oh, I only lost one third of everything I tried to do, right? And I've got my failure rate down now to about 2%.
Jeez, that's amazing.
But It's an art. I am always amazed. Fat Dragon Games, Tom Tullis, love the fact he spends hours trying to figure out the best settings to print his stuff and then publishing them for everyone else. Like, hey, this is exactly what I'm doing to get really good prints. And then he publishes that out to everyone. Let's be honest. I have laser printers for my business, and you know, Office Space is right. The first thing you want to do half the time with your laser printer is grab a baseball bat and just start hitting it as much as you can. 3D printers take that and multiply it by a factor. I mean, it's the number of things that can go wrong is little things like with mine. It's like, I'll come down and while I've got it dialed in, it's little things like my printer. If there is a hiccup in the internet while I'm sending the file wirelessly to the printer, there's no error check on it.
Right.
So it will receive the file, have the hiccup, and then finish receiving the file. And then while it's printing, when it hits that hiccup point, it just stops. And that's it. It's dead. Little things like I just invested $600 on big uninterrupted power supplies because the 3D printers that I use, half a second brownout and the job is lost and the entire print job is gone. It's messy that, you know, if you use PLA, you've got to make sure it's ventilated because that stuff is not good to breathe. You can't just put this on your small apartment. You can't put a PLA printer in your small apartment and expect to live a long life, basically. Or at least you shouldn't.
I spend an embarrassing amount of money on miniatures and terrain. It's embarrassing. And I've had several people say, hey, Craig, why don't you get a 3D printer? And I'm like, quite frankly, I don't have the time. I know that what it takes, I don't need another freaking hobby, right? I just need stuff for my hobby.
Right.
And so my heart goes out to people that put the time and effort into it. But Tom, I was thinking that was going to be your answer, and it validates what my thoughts were. I mean, and I love what you said. It's an art, and it really is. And I see what people are doing to try to make it the quality good and the viability good. And, you know, to your point, you know, there's cheap printers out there, but guess what they do? They print cheap stuff, right? That doesn't print the stuff that you want. And you've got to make the investment. And are you ready to make that sunk cost? So how about some predictions, Tom? What do you think the industry is going to look like in five years?
I'll be very curious. In 5 years, the 3D printing is going to be where everything goes to. So the question is going to end up being, how inexpensive, how high a quality does that 3D printing get? I really think you're just going to see a continuation of this. I don't know that 3D printers can get much cheaper. I mean, if you look at a laser printer, I mean, that technology actually is not, in terms of how the things happen with the laser heating, the laser etching, I'm going to have some people like, you have no idea. I know how it all works, but what I'm saying is laser printers aren't $50.
Right.
You're still having, so I think the lower end, but still good resin printers, I don't know how much cheaper they can get.
Right.
And still produce something that you feel like having. What will be really interesting is if the high-end printers, like I'm getting, if those come down in price, I think that really changes the playing field drastically. I have four 3D printers, and I wear them out about every 18 months.
No kidding.
Okay. So about every 18 months, I have to spend about $3,000 to replace it.
Unbelievable.
$2,500 about every 18 months to replace each one. But I actually, on my Facebook page, I actually show people the stuff that I'm doing. One of the best compliments I got, I posted a video a few months ago where I had printed a Hawacha, which is a it's an Oriental Gatling gun essentially created in ancient times, where it was a whole bunch of arrows into this big big machine, and they all had rockets attached to them, and they would run over and they would light like a 50 of these rockets, and they would launch these arrows like just a massive, and then they could load up the next round of rocket arrows. Well, so the thing that I printed is just a showing all of these arrows sticking out of the Hawacha. And I took the model and put my hand on top of the arrows and bent them over flat and then let them come back.
Wow.
That's the resin that I actually found a resin that is actually designed to use to make working gears for working machines.
Interesting.
So it's meant to make replacement parts for machine equipment. So it has to be really durable. It has to be able to flex as it's happening without shattering. Well, that makes really cool miniatures, because one of the biggest problems with really detailed miniatures is that if you drop it or you mishandle it, it breaks. And so I've got this really great resin, but you know, the resin's expensive, the printers are expensive, and I just bake all that into my cost. But when you're asking, like, you know, that's my rambling way of saying, where is the big change? The big change comes is if that $2,500 printer, if that suddenly costs like $500,
right?
That really will change a lot of things, because now you're producing, I mean, my equipment is high enough, and I won't get into what games I'm doing for, but I actually work with companies that I print the prototypes that then go to molding for them to mass produce for some fairly large company board games. And that's mostly because since I'm small, I have really high-end equipment, and I can pivot their orders in usually a week and a half.
That's huge.
And then it usually my prices right now are usually at least are usually around 40% less than what other major places are charging. So I have a fast pivot, really high-end equipment. But if you suddenly make everything that I'm doing very cost effective for other people to get into, I mean, that will really change everything. I mean, one of the reasons why my 3D printing business is growing so rapidly is I've made that investment, and it's an investment I have to keep making. It's not a one-time thing. Every year I'm dropping 10 grand on 3D printers. But if suddenly that investment is 2 grand a year, I think you really change who gets into it and what's available. And
well, and the other piece of it, though, too, that you bring to it, and I don't think you're, I think you're underselling it, is the expertise, right? And that's a part of it. It's not just, you can't, people listening right now cannot go out there and spend $3,000 on a printer and anticipate to be run out of the gate making miniatures quality enough that somebody would use it as a prototype or a mold. There's a lot of time and investment and learning that has occurred, I would imagine, Tom, that, yeah, that gives you at least a running start, right? So if we do see those drop.
Yeah, I've actually broken and done things with these printers that I've been on phone calls with the engineers, and they're like, no, that's not possible. And then I've actually like send them detailed videos of what's happening, and they're like, okay, we need to rethink everything, because you've just like you
blew their mind.
I've had a couple times where the engineers have been like, okay, we were pretty sure that couldn't happen. You know, the biggest one was my company that I go with came out with a new version of their printer, and I got back to them and I said, look, the new printers are using material 20% faster than the old ones. And they're like, well, that's not possible. I'm like, no. I says, look, take, and this is something they'd never try. I said, here's a print job. Print it on your old printer. Print it on your new printer and weigh them. The new ones weigh 20% more. And they're like, it's not physically possible for us to be adding 20% more density to them. I'm like, just do it. Like, I get this little email back from the company. We have to rethink everything. Thank you.
And that's you know, something.
So, and I mean, that's really, it's, and it's not, I think that's the biggest thing I would drive home is where does this all end up? If the economies of scale start really kicking in, on the high end stuff. And I, the lower end printers can make some beautiful, I've seen some really beautiful things. But you still have, I mean, you still have problem like the, and those are all the resin printers. Well, that's, you know, the resin has to have special things for getting rid of it. You can't just dump it down the sink. There's a lot of hassle involved, but I think you're going to see a movement of more people able to get really high-end stuff in their own houses, or if the cost of the printers and the resin and everything become more affordable, companies like me that can sell you the prints will be able to get our prices down. I mean, keeping in mind, I said that the 3D print right now, material and everything, and the wear and tear, that's 50% more in costs than me molding and making the model, right?
Right.
Well, if that comes down 50%, and now I don't need to mold anything more, and I can sell all of my product as a one-piece model, and I never have to worry about, you know, somebody having to glue my stuff together anymore, and that would be game-changing. And if we hit that, I think a lot of stuff changes.
That's fantastic. So. That's fantastic. So, Tom, we're going to take one last break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about what do I see when I go to the website. We're going to talk about the product line. If you've never been to Impact Miniatures website, it's almost overwhelming what you can buy. It's a ton of stuff. So I want to walk through the miniatures, the dice, and something we haven't touched on. I want to talk about some of the games that Impact Miniatures has released. So we'll be right back.
There are so many online retailers. It can be hard to find one that is trustworthy, has great prices, along with some reliable customer service. On the third floor, we love ordering our gaming goodies from Gadzooks Gaming. Their selection of terrain, miniatures, dice, custom decor, and conversion bits are curated for gamers by gamers. You'll find they have what you need and what you didn't know you needed to take your gaming fun to the next level. If you mention Third Floor Wars in the cart notes of your order, you'll also get a free gift and you'll help support the podcast. Check out GadzooksGaming.com and mention Third Floor Wars on checkout to get that free gift.
So, Tom, I want to start off by talking about kind of what we've already talked about. So let's talk about just miniatures. So we've got chibi models, and it sounds like we've got almost everything we could dream of as far as, you know, the different types of stuff that are available from a chibi standpoint. How about for fantasy football? What can people find on the website for that?
We still have a lot of really good $35 resin teams, and we have – The biggest thing that happened was the fantasy football scale changed in 2016 from 28 mil to 32 mil scale. And so a lot of our product range was hand sculpted. So it was, I mean, for effectively it and this is one of the biggest things that when I was telling you, like, hey, 75% of my business now is not the thing that we did exclusively for the first half of the company's life.
Right.
And part of that is, you know, you wake up and you suddenly realize that the thing you started your company in is entirely the wrong scale and you have no way to fix that.
Yep.
You have to pivot or die. And yep. That's kind of what we did. Now, we did have some of our later stuff that was done digitally. And so that's okay. We'll grab all that stuff and you make it 18% larger and huzzah, we're new scale. But So that was a big blow to the fantasy football section of the store.
I'm sure.
The other problem that I have is just like I said, I just run out of time in each day. I actually have licensed lifetime licenses for approximately 2,500 miniatures.
That are not
in the store because I haven't had time to set them up in my 3D printer and see how much they'll cost to print. But I look for Kickstarters by very talented people. Usually it's their first or second. And my son actually says, man, when you describe this, it sounds like you're exploitive. And I'm like, I don't know of any other way to say it. You look for someone who's really talented. They're doing their first or second Kickstarter and no one's taken them aside and said, dude, do you know how much your stuff is really worth? And they frequently have a, hey, give me $100 and you will get a lifetime print license for everything plus all the stretch goals. And they end up unlocking 49 models. And all of a sudden now I've picked up 49 models. I can print the rest of my life without paying anyone. And I bought them for $2 a piece compared to in the old days when I hand sculpted. It was $10 a millimeter was the going rate.
Difference. Yeah.
You know, so all of a sudden now, instead of $300 for a 30 mil model, I just paid $2.
Right. And you've got the technology and the expertise to actually print it and make it look good.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a real big deal. How about this chibi crate that I see on the website? What's that?
That's fun. So I work with Capsule Chibi Patreon, and it's a really incredible Patreon that produces, they produce about 12 to 15 chibi models every month for their people. And then what the chibi crate is every 2 months, I take all of the models from 4 and 3 months ago. And you get a pick, depending upon if you're in the basic level, you get a pick 2 you want and 2 you absolutely don't want. If you're in the ducks, it's 3 and 3. And then I pick some extras to fill it out and we print them off. So every 2 months you get, you know, a box that contains 6 to 12 chibi miniatures. Unfortunately, you know, I've got 3 subscribers. So it didn't take off like some loot. I actually don't know how well some other people. I know there are entire places that do really well with loot crates.
You see a lot of loot crates come and go. So
I've been doing this now for 2 years. So I've been running this for 2 years. I still have 3 people getting them. So I'll call that a victory. It's not sure. Dead. But and what I always tell my wife is like, look, at the end of the day, those 3 people, it's still $200 I didn't have every 2 months. So, and I'm old school, so I can look at it like that. Like, hey, it's set up, it works. It's an extra $200, you know. But I had higher dreams for that didn't pan out. But I have a license with him, and he has produced over 500 chibi models. And so I pay him a monthly license and I can print as many of his models as I want.
That's great.
With a monthly license. That's the only person that I have done a monthly deal with instead of, I just want how much to pay you for a lifetime. Like I never send you another dime. I'm going to send you some money right now. Herberto. And he's the one who does the live sculpting twice a month.
That's great.
So he's the current Kickstarter we have running. He's the sculptor of that entire Kickstarter.
That's
so
awesome.
Since we're not. So, you know, it's great.
So talk to me about Elf Ball.
So Elf Ball was I had been helping design fantasy football games. And when that project finished, I really felt like there were things that I wanted to do with the rules I didn't get a chance to or wasn't allowed to. So I worked with, I bought the rights to a game from Phil Bowen that was very rough. It used rulers, and it was very much of almost a Warhammer type feel football game. And then we changed it to be hex based movement with stats, balance the teams. And so we came up with our own version of a fantasy football game. I had a lot of people who have played it, who have told me that's really great. I want to be very clear. I'm not suggesting that it was copied in any way, but it was really interesting in that a lot of what was in Elf Ball for mechanics and everything showed up a couple years later in Manic's Dreadball. And I truly believe, I honestly believe this, even though I was working with the guy that wrote most of the rules for Dreadball, I really believe that that was both of us seeing the holes
right
in another large fantasy game and coming to similar conclusions of ways right. that we would fix them. I don't think he copied Elf Ball. I think we both came to a very similar solution. Because there's if you look at the rules for Elf Ball and you look at the rules for Dreadball, there are a lot of similarities of how we approach dealing with certain things. And I was a big fan. I went through a phase where I was convinced that the future of Impact was game manufacturing. We were going to start making our own games. I started hunting for games that I could buy from companies that weren't really doing anything with them and go through the rules, update them, rewrite them, and produce them. And so we produced a series over the course of 2 years. I think we produced 6 total card and board games. It took me years to recover from the financial hit that created. And then when they didn't, the bottom line is, unless you're a really big company, it is really hard to get mass sales of an actual manufactured game. And some of them are really good. Like, if I haven't looked a long time, but last time I looked at Board Game Geek, most of the games that I designed had fairly good ratings. But, you know, that doesn't help you if no one buys them.
I agree.
I actually had someone write a review for my rewrite. I did a massive rewrite to the game, the card game Force Ball, which a reviewer that I sent it to said, this is the best $5 card game I've ever seen.
That's awesome.
It sits on Amazon. I don't think I've sold a single copy in the last 2 years. So, you know, it's just there's a lot of stuff out there. And so what that taught
me, it's a real crowded field right now, Tom. It's hard. Yeah, it's hard.
And so what that taught me was, even though I probably, based on those ratings, appear to have talent to write games rules, it is not the way I pay my mortgage successfully. So despite having talent, despite appearing to have a knack for it, I abandoned that because I can't feed my family creating games. And I pivoted into components. And that's where I live now, is I live in the component space.
Well, so now let's pivot to what does pay the mortgage. I want to talk about your dice. So what is unique about your dice?
So what's unique about Impact Miniatures dice is we make the size of dice that no one else makes. So, many companies can hand you the 7 D&D dice sets, but Impact actually makes dice for all of the sides, all the way from 3 to 21. So we have all of the dice shapes between those two ranges and all of the evens between 4 and 30. Where this is important, and I've had people like, I don't understand, why would I ever need a D19? So where this all came from was there was a move in RPGs by several games, and I honestly am surprised that more games have not grabbed these mechanics, and they're called dice chain mechanics. So I really enjoy watching there's a YouTube channel, Viva La Dirt League, where they play D&D and you watch as they play it. But what makes it fun is they are actors. So when key scenes happen while they're playing the D&D, they actually then cut and show them in costume as their characters acting out the scenes. So it's fun to watch, but constantly while watching, they're like, okay, you need to roll to do this. Okay, I'm going to roll. And now, okay, what's my modifier? Oh, my modifier's the, and so all the, right? Dice chain has no, you don't modify. So if you get better at something, you use the next dice in the chain. So if you normally roll a D6 for damage and you suddenly become stronger or better at using the weapon, now you roll a D7 for damage. You move up the chain. And you can either do that single digits, or I work with a game role playing game called Free Blades. They do it in evens. So you move up the chain in evens. You get rid of the modifiers. The other beauty of getting rid of modifiers, and this is coming from my game design background, is most games have to have special rules for nat one, right? Well, you know, oh, you rolled a nat one, so it doesn't matter what your modifiers were. Well, when you have a game where you just move up the dice chain, a one is a one. There's no nat one anymore. A one is a one, and you don't have to have special rules for all of, you know, all the extras that come with it.
Well, and it takes the math out too, right? Right. So now instead of being D6 plus one and D20 minus three, I just grab my 17 sided die and I roll it. And whatever I roll, I roll. Yeah, that's cool. That's very, very cool.
Free Blades uses a dice chain. Dungeon Crawl Classics uses a dice chain. I have a couple smaller games that have reached out to me that I've sent them sets because they're working on designing. But the two big ones currently on the market are Free Blades and Dungeon Crawl Classics. They both use dice chain mechanics, and we make the dice for those two games.
That's great. DCC has got a nice following too. I know that's a very popular game.
I love DCC.
Yeah.
I think all anyone ever has to do with, you know, two things that sold me on DCC. And what's funny is, the story of that was my business partner, Chris, was the DCC player. I just like making cool new things. So I made a D7, a D14. I paid for steel molds to make these dice. So I'm like, hey, these are just cool. I want to make these dice. Well, we also had some dice from some other companies, and I had people who were coming to the booth and they're like, hey, did you know you have all 14 of the dice you need to have a DCC set? And I'm like, oh, no, that didn't mean anything to me. And it's like, but I'm glad I can help you, right? I have my back turned to the booth at Gen Con, and all of a sudden my business partner grabs my shoulder. Joseph Goodman is at the front of our booth. Means nothing to me, right? And I'm like, well, that's nice. He's like, please go talk to him. Go talk to him. Find out why he's at the front of our booth. And that was the whole, hey, I see you have no one at that point in the rule book for DCC. It actually included like, hey, to roll a D14, you know, roll a D20 and ignore any result higher, right? I was the first company to actually have all 14 dice for his game.
That's cool.
Never had heard of the game. I was just literally, my wife jokes that it's the dice field of dream stories. That's I built it and someone came.
That's really funny.
So we got into making DCC size dice by accident. And now we are the official creator of those. But they're not easy to make. I mean, I when we lost our dice manufacturer, as I was talking about earlier in the interview, it took me a long time to find anyone willing to touch. And it comes down to, I have people come to the booth at Gen Con. Are these dice made in the United States? No, I'm sorry, they're not. Well, I don't want to. I'm like, look, go find me someone to make my dice in the United States. They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, no one will touch them. That doesn't make any sense. Okay, no, wait. Let me explain this to you for business side. People that make dice in the United States, they make them for casinos. Why do they do that? because the average casino will literally go through like 1,000 dice a day at their craps table that they then retire and bring in all new dice. Why would I want to take an order from me to make 1,000 sets of these weird ass dice when literally one casino in Vegas is going through that in 2 hours?
Exactly. Yeah.
There's just no reason. So you have to find, for me, you have to find a small company that's willing to do something really weird that is going to push them for designing the mold correctly. And it's just not easy to do that. So
that's really, really cool. Well, I've been hunting for Mr. Goodman to get him on the show to talk about DCC. Oh, yeah. And I'm going to have to throw your name around a little bit.
What I wanted to tell you is what sold me on DCC was two things, since I didn't know anything about the game. The first one was that when you start a DCC game, you roll up 6 characters and you take them into the first module. Whoever actually lives is the character you should use going forward. That type of, oh my God, I love the strategy. And one of the things that always concerned me when I was young is character attachment. God, you come to the game with a 12-page backstory. Now I feel bad when I kill you, okay? And I love the fact in DCC, they're like, look, these are peasants going into dungeons. They're going to die. And so there's actual, like, it feels real. And I absolutely love that. The other thing is looking at, like, the spell effect. Any, you just have to look at a single spell effect in DCC. And it's amazing because all of a sudden it's like, okay, you roll for the spell anywhere from it critically fails and your arm turns into a tentacle to, oh, the fireball works. To, uh-oh, you just literally summoned a stream of lava from your hand that melts everything in a 2-mile radius. If it, oh, like, you know, it's, yeah, I love the chaos.
It's a very unique system. And boy, the people that love Dungeon Crawl Classic love Dungeon Crawl Classic for the type of stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah. And making the dice for that game, I'm going to give a shout out. I hope someone gets to the, Joseph Goodman is, hands down, one of the greatest people I've worked with in the entire time I've had Impact. Just an amazing human being.
Oh, that makes me happy because I've heard good stuff about Joseph. So if you're listening, Joseph, you need to come on my show.
You know what? I'll send him a link.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Because I've been getting a lot of RPG designers on the show, and I've had a great time talking to them. Well, Tom, what a great time. I really appreciate you sitting around and wasting 2 hours talking to me and my listeners. It was very, very interesting to hear multiple aspects, really the business side, which I got to be honest, Tom, I wasn't anticipating to talk about that this much, but we haven't really talked about it with other guests. So it was really good to kind of get that insight. Obviously, Tom, they need to head over to Impact Miniatures. We're going to have the link here in the show notes for everybody. What are the three things they need to look for when they get on this site? So three things that you think people need to look at that'll knock their socks off.
All right. Three things to look at. If you are a fantasy gamer, check out the section for Heartbreaker. We managed to inherit the estate of the person that was the lead miniature designer for Heartbreaker, and we're able to resurrect all of those old Kev Adams, Phil Lewis, Tim Prow, those incredible sculpts from the 80s. We're able to bring those back to life. And I've actually been told that because of changes in mold technology, since we got the original masters from the estate, current mold technology, I have people come to the booth with our resin model that we make and the metal model from the 80s. And they're like, why is there more detail on your model? And it's simply because the material technology has progressed, that they can now press more details out of those original masters.
Isn't that something?
But the first belief is that's not what happened, and somehow you've faked it. Like, this isn't, and we're using the exact. So that was a huge thing. A lot of people don't know that we have that range, and they're just, I mean, I like digital sculpts, but those original old fantasy models by Kev and Tim and Phil, they're amazing. And yeah, they have so much character and
a lot of character and nostalgia. Let's be honest. I mean,
yeah.
You know, there's a reason there's a huge underground movement for literally the original GW,
yeah.
you know, sculpts out there, and the plastic sprues for, you know, the Citadel miniatures from, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Right. Quite frankly, they're ugly, especially when you compare it to that. But it's cool. It's cool to in a nostalgic way to grab that. Go ahead.
And just really quick. And because of the resin production and everything, like, you can get an entire 26 Kev Adam Dwarf Army and it's like $40.
That's amazing.
For 26 models. So
that's cool. What's next after that?
I would definitely have people look at the chibi section. That's probably one of our most popular ranges. I know there are some X's. We are working on getting some of the, it's a case of product growing faster than someone having time to put the images on the website. but we are working on that, but we still have the largest single chibi model selection of any company in the world. So that's if you're great. Looking to grab a good single chibi model for a specific thing, and if you're an adult gamer, you're going, why would I want chibi? I have people all the time come to our booth at Adepticon, Gen Con, who are using our models to introduce their children either to painting or to role playing. Because the kids, but for some reason that cartoon feel of the model helps them connect, and especially for painting. I have a lot of people buy these as the first models they give their kids to get them into hobby painting.
That's really, really cool. And then for my RPG listeners, they're obviously going to go to the dice section if they're fans of Dungeon Crawl Classic.
Don't go to our website to buy our dice.
Oh,
I will
okay.
tell you that right now. Go to Amazon and type Impact Miniatures Dice.
Perfect.
And that that is the better place where we keep everything very up to date. I am still working on updating the dice section of my own site, but we're kind of transitioning that our website is mostly concentrated right now on the miniatures and the 3D printing. And we have the dice business set up on Amazon. The other reason for that is, remember, I told you that there was so much work with Impact, I had to divide it up. Well, by having all the dice sales go through Amazon, my wife handles making sure all of that ships out. And if it goes to the store, it doesn't flow into the software the same way. And
got it. All right. So we'll have a link to those dice on Amazon.
That'd be great.
All right. Wonderful. Tom, thanks again for coming by and talking to us.
I really appreciate you having me. Thank you.
All right. And for those of you that stayed around to the end to listen, I appreciate it. Take care.
Hey, did you hear that? You leveled up. You finished another episode of Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars. If you want more from the Third Floor, follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Head on over to our YouTube channel. It is packed with painting tutorials, gaming tips, battle reports, and role-playing actual plays. Did you enjoy this episode? Why don't you send a link to one of your friends so they can enjoy it too? Last but not least, write us a review on your podcatcher of choice. This helps us find listeners almost as cool as you.
This will be probably relatively short because I want to have time to really talk about the last segment, about all the goodies that you're selling. But the idea here is, you know, how do you think things are going? What stuff that you're excited about for miniature gaming? What do you think the future looks like?
Got it. I wrote notes about all your question prep, so I'm good.
Oh, I appreciate it.
I'm ready for you, man.
Awesome. All right, I'll bring us back.
Hey, are you still here? Look, the podcast is over, and you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, you might as well run over to patreon.com. Become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast too while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.